people, but my parents were, I suppose you'd call them lower working class, but they were such lovely people, so kind, honest, hardworking, self-effacing. They'd help anybody. In fact, they were not nicer than a lot of Christians I know, you know. And
except this lot that's in the semen.
This place nice. Accepted, yes.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult, really, to win them for Christ. But at the age of 13, someone put a leaflet through our door saying there was a new Sunday school starting down the road in the school. And it was, I think, the fifth or sixth branch Sunday school from a Pentecostal church in the middle of the city. Mm. And my father said, "How about going, John?" You know, I said, I'd left Sunday school a year before, the Methodist church Sunday school. I said, "Nah, Sunday school is for kids. I'm 13 now, you know." And he said, "Well, I'll give you half a crown." Well, that's 12 and a half p.
Yeah.
You know, in the new money, 12 and a half p. Well, that was 5 weeks pocket money, you know. And so I said, "Well, make it 5 shillings. 25p.
Yeah, don't push your luck.
There must be some Scottish blood in me somewhere.
Yeah.
I said, make it 5 shillings and I'll go. So he said, he stuck at half a crown. I said, okay, one half crown, one Sunday. That's the deal. So I went along and I just loved it. And I came. He said, there were 50 kids there. And he said, what was it like? I said, it was good. I said, but there was a boy there with a frock on. His name was Dewar. And he was a Scot, and he got a kilt on. And it was the first time I'd seen a kilt, you know. And we became very, very good friends. But my Sunday school teacher took me along. She said, "Well, how about coming to hear Billy Graham?" Mm-hmm. And he was an American Baptist evangelist at that time who was having great crowds listening to him. I think he preached to more people than anyone else in history. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Methodist Central Hall. He was in London. No pictures. It was just the sound coming over. And that night I realized I had a need of God in my life. I mean, how wicked can you be at 13? Well, I think you've got a 13-year-old, haven't you?
12. Yeah.
Well, then you know something about it.
That's right. Yeah. No, he's good. He's here tonight.
Yeah. Yeah,
his head's just shot up there.
But, you know, I knew that... We don't need a preacher to tell us, do we?
No.
That we're not what we ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that. And that night I opened up my life and said, "God, I want you in my life. Thank you for dying on that cross for me. Will you be my friend and my savior?" Yeah. And, you know, it was a life-changing experience and it's never stopped.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I went on. And in fact, that was on the Thursday night. On the Sunday, I was preaching in the open air. I'd read Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and a bit of Acts by Sunday. Couldn't put the book down. And so I was preaching in the open air on the Sunday night at 13.
And it's not stopped since.
And it's not stopped since.
Nothing stopped you. Brilliant.
Yeah. So
brilliant.
I went to school and then I started work in the aircraft industry, went into aeronautical engineering, and ended up really in the technical publications department, producing illustrations for military aircraft, for maintenance and servicing of military aircraft. There was a girl in the church. Well, there were a lot of girls in the church. Yeah, but there was this one, and she was a German girl, and I'd not noticed her. She'd been there nearly 4 years, and I'd hardly noticed her. There were about 300 folk in the church, I guess. But suddenly, I was 22, I think. Suddenly, someone switched the light on. You know, and I realized that I needed this girl in my life.
Did she have that same realization about you?
Well, I'm coming to that. I guess I was obeying the Lord's injunction, love your enemies. I walked home with her from church one Sunday night. I've never spoken much to her. We'd never held hands or anything like that. We got to the gate where she was staying. She was doing her nurse's training in England, preparatory to going to India as a missionary. And she stood one side of the gate and I stood the other. And I said, and I remember the words exactly because I'd practiced them for a whole week. I said, "I've decided I'm going to marry you." And she looked at me. And I said, I've been talking to the boss about it, and he says it's okay, so I won't take no for an answer. Now, guys, you young guys, this is the way to do it. It works every time. Well, it worked for me anyway. Because she didn't say no. I was amazed.
Yeah.
Well, irresistible charm, maybe. I don't know. But she said, well, I'm going to India in, I think, 6 weeks' time. I said, that's all right. You know, you go to India. And I'm leaving my job and I'm going to theological college. Mm-hmm. So we started courting. We had a few weeks of courting. Half of it I spent in Ragmore Hospital, Inverness, with a fractured spine.
Ouch.
Motorcycle accident up somewhere near Cape Roth. And on a climbing holiday. She went to India, and for 3 years our courtship was done by letters and no Skyping or anything like that.
You might need to have to explain what a letter is to some of the folks that are up there.
Yeah.
Back in the olden days when there wasn't internet and emails and Skype, you used a pen and a paper and a stamp and an envelope.
I'd send a letter to her and I'd get an answer in about 4 weeks' time, you know. Mm. Yeah. And she came back. After 3 years, it was a hard 3 years.
Yeah.
And I'd finished in theological college, and we got married, mm-hmm. and started in our first church in Yorkshire, good place to be. We had two children. Mm-hmm. Actually, we had moved already to Devon by then, North Devon, and our daughter Helga was our firstborn, mm-hmm. and then 3 years later, Marcus, our son. Yeah. Okay.
Wow. So family has been formed,
yep.
and life and ministry is fulfilling, yeah. and is going well for you.
Yes.
And so family beginning to grow up then. What was your family like? What was in particular your daughter Helga? Yep. Tell us a little bit about her.
She was a bubbly, bright young thing. And all of this happened, she was 19, but she'd got a place in King Edward VI High School for Girls, which we were told was one of the top six girls' schools in the country.
Okay.
We couldn't afford to send her there. It was in Birmingham, but she got a scholarship. In fact, she got two scholarships to go there. She was very average intellectually there, but she shone in music. Mm-hmm. She sang with the Birmingham Bach Choir and the National Youth Choir. She toured with the National Youth Choir. She played the violin in two orchestras and led all the worship in our church from the piano. We had a 14-piece orchestra at that time with bassoons and clarinets and all mm-hmm. sorts of things. She wanted to sing professionally.
Okay.
That was her ambition. But she loved the Lord. She at the age of eight she'd found Jesus as her friend, mm-hmm. and she was a lovely girl.
Yes, yeah. And so she'd left school, she had the possibility of life before her,
yeah.
a career in music, and, yes. and tell us.
She had a place to go to Lancaster University to study music, and then onto the Royal Northern College of Music. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to sing professionally. That was okay. her ambition. She said she wanted to sing in La Scala, Milan, mm-hmm. Covent Garden, and the New York Met. I said to her, well, Helga, aim high. You just might hit something.
Yeah. Yeah. Good advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, so Helga decides that she's going on a trip.
Yeah, she took a gap year before okay. going to uni. And she had been in New Jersey working as a nanny with her family there with three small children. And she'd been there for a few months, came home for the week before Christmas to collect her music prize from the school mm. and to meet up with all her friends who'd gone up to universities around the country. So we had quite a lovely week. And we'd had our teenage problems, you know.
Joys.
Pardon?
The joys.
The joys, the, yeah. The Dad, I hate you.
Yeah.
Sort of thing, you know. Dad, stop sniffing. And such things as this. And when I asked for a plate and a knife and fork in McDonald's, that was the end of it, you know.
Yeah.
She wasn't with me at all.
Shamed yeah. with your daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another story. Mm. But But it had all come good. We had a lovely relationship. And for that week, I was the taxi driver. Dad, will you pick me up at Emma's? Will you take me here? And then I took her down to Heathrow on the Thursday, at the 21st of December, for her to get her flight back to the States for a few more months before coming home to go to uni. Mm.
So yeah. You dropped her off at the airport and then you drove back?
I went down and I sat with her. We had an orange juice together. And I remember Terminal 3 was being radically remodeled. Mm-hmm. It was all temporary partitioning inside. And she went to the departure area, and I suppose from here to that door she was away, and she turned around and put down her little carry-on bag. She wasn't very tall. Mm-hmm. I think you'll see a picture of her in a bit. And she sort of ran back and flung her arms around me. She had long auburn hair, wavy auburn hair. And she said something to me, and I wish I could remember what it was, but I can't. I remember what I said to her, though. I said, Helga, I do love you. It doesn't always look like it, but I do. And I remember the smell. She'd washed her hair with a green apple shampoo, which was all the rage at that time. Mm-hmm. And whenever I'm in an orchard, I can smell it again. Mm-hmm. So off she went, and I drove back to Birmingham, and the phone rang, and it was a widow lady from our church who'd had 8 boys.
Wow.
Yeah, 8 boys.
God bless her.
Yeah, God bless her. I said to Winnie, her name was Winnie. And I said, Auntie Winnie, we all call her Auntie Winnie. I said, why didn't you stop with 8? You nearly got your football team, you know. But our Helga, she doted on our Helga. She was the daughter she always wanted. And she said, oh, Pastor, because I was the minister of that church, did Helga get away all right? Mm-hmm. I said, yes, thanks, Winnie. Why? Oh, she said, there's been a plane crash in Scotland. Yeah. Now, I was the missions director for our churches at that time for Asia, and I'd traveled, well, I've preached in 42 countries around the world. But I'd never been to the States at that point. Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, Scotland was up there and the United States was over there. Mm. I didn't know that was the way they went sometimes in those days. Well, as they do now. So I said, oh, thank you, Winnie. Put down the phone, turned on the TV and called my wife and my son, Marcus. Marcus was 15 at that time then, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And shall we see that clip now?
Yeah, I think we've got that.
We've got a clip.
We've got a clip to be able to show.
It lasts just over 3 minutes, just over 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. It is part of a BAFTA. It won the BAFTA award in the 10th year after Lockerbie, 1998, as the best documentary of the year. The very first bit, you'll understand, isn't part of the newsflash, but the rest of it is the newsflash that we saw that night on the TV. Yeah. Obviously, this bit wasn't on the news. Thank you.
Well, thank you, guys. So, John, tell us what your response was when you began to see those images, when, to coin, I suppose, a rather crude expression, when the penny began to drop.
Yeah.
That perhaps that was a flight that Helga was on. What went through your mind? What began to happen? What was the chain of events that then took place?
Well, our son was sitting on the sofa, like I'm sitting here. My wife was sitting on the arm here, and I was standing next to her looking at the television over there. And I remember saying, how awful, these poor people. Mm-hmm. You know, we're observers of other people's tragedies. Other people's disasters. These things don't happen to us, do they? Mm. You know, and especially stuff that's on the television. That's another world out there. Mm-hmm. That's nothing to do with us. And even, you know, when they said Pan Am, and I checked her bags in, and it still wasn't there. But you know, mothers have another. An extra sense, a sixth sense about these things. It came up on the screen, Pan Am Flight 103, and Lisa said, that's Helga's plane. And there was a stunned silence that seemed to go on forever, but I suppose it was just a few seconds. The silence was broken by Marcus yelling at the screen, "No, no, no, no!" And my wife, the words hardly able to crawl out of her mouth, "Helga, Helga, Helga." Strangely, I couldn't find any words at all. I just stood there. We watched the whole news flash, and then it went on to other things. I think I remember they were talking about how much was being spent on credit cards that Christmas. We turned off the TV and we stood together in our sitting room, put our arms around each other, the three of us, and we asked God to help us.
Wow.
And looking back, Gordon, I have to say the grace of God has been more than sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
It has been an amazing experience. Yes, there's been a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. Yes, there have been a lot of tears. But somehow, overarching it all, there has been a sense of peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scripture set talks about the peace of God that passes understanding. I think a better translation, I'm not a Greek scholar, but I know enough Greek to be able to see it, that a better translation is, it's the peace of God that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we've at times almost felt guilty.
Mm-hmm.
That we were not falling apart at the seams,
mm-hmm.
when we thought we ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that grace, that peace has kept us all through this time.
And so you have had an initial shock. You have found the courage, the strength,
yeah.
to pray together as a family, to comfort each other.
Mm.
Does news then begin to spread?
Oh, yes. Within minutes, the phone was ringing. We didn't live too far from the church in Oldbury, and some of her friends knew she was flying with Pan Am.
Okay.
And some of the other folk in the church, and they were ringing up, you know. And I always keep a reporter's notebook by the phone, and in the following 4 weeks, we had over 600 phone calls from around the world.
Wow.
You know, wanting to know how we were doing and that. Mm-hmm. Within an hour, we had 40 people in our home, or 40 people had passed through our
right.
home within an hour.
Okay.
Yeah. Some came and just, folk from the church, some came and just sat quietly and left.
Mm-hmm.
Some came and prayed for us and left. Some came and they fell apart and we had to help them. But, you know, folks, with all its faults, the church, and it's got plenty of faults. Again, with the exception of this one.
Right answer.
With all its faults, this is a great family to belong to.
Mm-hmm.
You young people grow up in the security of this family. It's terrific.
Yeah.
And I think it was the prayers of those people that carried us through, really. Yeah.
And I'm assuming then that news began to spread beyond friends and family to the authorities, to the media. You know, yeah. What happened, you know, with regard to that?
Yeah, the next day,
yeah.
Around about half past 4 or 5 o'clock, it was raining, it was cold and dark, and the doorbell rang, and I went to the door, and it was ITN.
Mm-hmm.
Could they have an interview? And I said, well, if I went in, I left them standing in the rain while I asked my wife, did she think she could handle it? And we decided that while the world wanted to know what the Mosey family thought and felt, and maybe even what they believed,
yeah.
we had a responsibility. So I said, if you're honest with what we say to you and you don't cut it about and make nonsense of us, you're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
I must say, on the whole, with one exception, the Times newspaper, on the whole, the media has been very fair with us,
mm-hmm.
And treated us pretty honourably, and they've been a mouthpiece for us, and they've been a source of information. Some good investigative journalism has been helpful. So they came in and they set up. We've never seen a team like it. There were three fellas, you know, and usually now it's one man and his dog, and he's paid his own bus fare. But they came in and set up their lights and the camera, and the interviewer started, and he asked the questions. He said, and the questions were brilliant, Gordon. If I'd written them myself, they couldn't have been better. Mm. They walked right into it, really. He said, you know, you're a Christian minister. Hasn't this destroyed your faith? And when I look back now, where the answers came from, I think they came straight out of heaven. I said, well, this is where we prove whether what we've said we've believed for most of our lives, what we've taught and preached for most of our lives, this is where we prove whether it's real or whether it's just a game. Mm-hmm. And I said, sir, it's very early days, less than 24 hours. I said, but so far the grace of God has been more than sufficient.
So let me just backtrack just ever so slightly, because there are people that are in tonight, not everybody that I would know, so I wouldn't want to assume that everybody would know. What is it the centre, and what is it the hub of the Christian faith that we would believe, John? So do you maybe want to share just a little bit about what that Christian faith meant to you, and in those days, you know, and how that was able to...
I think it was mainly through having our heads in the Maker's Handbook.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Handbook
the
for Life.
Yeah.
That had given us some understanding of who God is, mm-hmm. and what he's like. Just a little glimpse. That he is a God of love and mercy and grace. And that he had come, and he'd come in person and died on a cross.
Mm-hmm.
In the form of Jesus Christ, rose again from the dead, and as he died on that cross, died in our place and took out the punishment for our inadequacy and for our sinfulness and our rebelliousness. And for those who believed and had trusted in him, as I had done as a 13-year-old,
yes.
That there was a fresh start, mm-hmm. forgiveness of the past. Mm. And we've lived and walked in the light of that, mm-hmm. the rest of our days, and that there's going to be a day when we're going to be with him, mm-hmm. forever and ever. Yeah.
And the assurance of that eternal life, and the assurance of heaven that doesn't just, you know, it's not just there for when you die, but eternal life that starts the moment you believe.
That's right. And of course, with our daughter, sure, we miss her.
Mm-hmm.
And in those early days, we cried a lot.
Yes.
And I'd see someone in a school, in the same school uniform sometimes, you know, in Birmingham. And I said, Helga, you know. But we're going to see her again.
Yes.
And it's going to be wonderful. Yeah.
Yes.
So he asked another question. He said, there are rumours that it might have been a bomb. And we didn't know that until the fourth day.
Okay.
Yeah. But this was only the first day afterwards. How do you feel about the people who put the bomb on the plane?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd worked in the aircraft industry. I knew 747s didn't just fall out of the sky, jumbo jets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'd said to my wife, there's dirty work afoot here, straight away. How do you feel about them, you see, they said, if it was a bomb? And I was trying to put together a succinct reply when my wife indicated she wanted to speak, and they turned the camera on her, and her answer was classic. She took them to the Sermon on the Mount, which people even from other religions or no religion at all often say is probably the finest code for living that there is. When Jesus said, she said, well, sir, Jesus said, if we don't forgive our enemies,
mm-hmm.
our Heavenly Father won't forgive us. So she said, we haven't killed anybody, but we are big sinners, and we're having to trust in the death and resurrection of Jesus as our only hope of forgiveness and of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, we dare not fool about by not forgiving. This went out on the 6 o'clock news, the 10 o'clock news that night on ITN. And I thought, wow, mm-hmm. what an answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, that Sermon on the Mount found the New Testament,
Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 and 15.
Yeah. For anybody that wants to check that out for themselves.
Matthew 6,
yeah.
14 and 15. Yeah.
Right. So that interview goes out live on or on the news that evening.
Yeah.
Now, you're as a church leader, you'd be a person of influence in your community, and you've got a church to lead, a church to run, people looking for answers, and yes, regardless of what point it is in the week, there's a Sunday coming. You know, so how did you handle that? How did you handle that first Sunday morning? Did you go to church?
Oh, yes.
did you take the service, or how did you cope and get through?
Well, it was Christmas, you know, and we always have a Christmas morning service. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what. I think the Sunday was Christmas Day that day. I'm pretty sure it was in 1988. So the 21st was the Thursday.
Friday,
22nd, 23rd.
24th would be Sunday, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, on the Sunday morning, or the Christmas morning, I'd already, before all this happened, I'd prepared my Christmas sermon. And my text was, "In the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son." And my opening sentence was, "There's an empty chair in heaven." I'd already written it in my introduction. There was an empty, for 33 years, there was an empty seat in heaven. Little thinking, little knowing how poignant, how relevant that was going to be to us. For we had every mealtime an empty chair at our table. And throughout the Christmas time, she wasn't there. And we opened presents, you know, from Helga with love to Mum. A nightie she'd bought in New York. To Dad, with love from Helga, a pair of gloves that I didn't even dare to wear. Mm-hmm. So I preached my sermon about the empty chair in heaven. Mm-hmm. We got through the Christmas. We had friends around. We've always had people who are in need or off the streets in our home over for Christmas meal, Christmas Day. That's been our regular practice all our 48 years of marriage. So we just carried on. We just missed Helga playing the recorder for the carols we sang around the Christmas tree. And we got through.
You managed to get through it.
Yeah.
And how was that in the house? I'm assuming that Helga must have had her room, her place. How was that for you? You know, was that, did you keep it as it was? Were there moments? Did you go into the room? Did you stay out of it? What emotions hit you when you...
Yeah. I kept going into her room. It was in the attic of our Victorian house where we lived. I remember on the fifth morning, on the fourth day, we'd heard that they'd found evidence that it was a bomb. And on the fifth morning, I went into her room. I hadn't slept very well that night. It was about 5:30 in the morning. And I was listening to her little reel-to-reel tape recorder. I wondered what music was the last music she'd been listening to. As I sat there, I was thinking of the news the night before. Howls of anger, particularly from the other side of the Atlantic, nuked the Arabs. They wanted the Middle East blowing off the planet. And I sat at her desk and I said, "Lord, I can't be like that. If I want someone dead because my daughter's dead, I reduce myself to the level of the terrorists. I make myself no better than them. But I've got to do something. I'm not one to sit by and do nothing." And as I was thinking, I don't remember whether I just opened my Bible and there it was, or whether I thought about it and looked it up. I don't recall. But I found myself reading from Paul's letter to the Christians in Rome, having a hard time under the Emperor Nero, being persecuted, being burnt and tortured. And he says, "Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil by doing good." Romans chapter 12, verse 21. Don't be overcome by evil. Overcome evil by doing good. And that's become our family motto. It's on the letter heading for our family charity. And I suppose me being here tonight is a part of trying to fulfill that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that has driven us forward from that day on.
And that was a moment of choice and of decision that yes, said, I'm going to do good.
Yeah, I didn't think of it like this at that time, but looking back, I was trying to find a strategy for surviving this blow that I'd received.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, the village of or town of Lockerbie suffered in the middle of it all. And I even know, even today, if I'm driving up the motorway and you see the signs for Lockerbie, you're not thinking of Lockerbie cheese. You're thinking of the fact that that was a place where that plane went down, and you know, lives were destroyed. They held a memorial service there, didn't they? Now, how did that affect? Did you go to that?
Yes,
were you
went
there?
To that.
Forgive the crudeness of the question, but. Had you Helga's body at that point for a funeral? Had that been recovered?
We hadn't had any information that she'd been found. In actual fact, she was found the next day, the day after it happened, but not identified. Mm-hmm. And she was identified later on from her dental records. So we had no news at all at that point. Mm-hmm. We'd had the West Midlands police come to our house, and not at that point, afterwards. So we came up to Lockerbie, and the service was in the Drivesdale Church, and we went there. Mrs. Thatcher was there, and various other people, dignitaries, ambassadors, and what have you. Mm-hmm. Nobody came and spoke to the relatives particularly. They were hobnobbing with the local nobs as well. We went from the church down to the police station in Lockerbie thinking, let's see if we can find any information. And the officer at the desk said, well, no, this isn't the right place to come. You need to go to the incident centre in the school, in the academy. Somehow incident centre, and I've done a lot of speaking to police forces about dealing with bereaved relatives. I think I've spoken to nearly every police force in the country, doing a whole day with different ranks through there, and about dealing with bereaved relatives in major disasters. And I usually say this, you know, an incident is a small issue on the side. It's incidental.
Yeah.
This wasn't incidental. This was the main thing. This is the main thing in our lives almost, you know. And I think that they have modified that somewhat, certainly in England anyway. I said to the police chief constable of Dumfries and Galloway, I think you ought to try and find a better word than incident. Mm-hmm. So we went to the incident centre, and a young policewoman came and brought us a cup of tea, and we were treated very, very well. We have great admiration for the police, who did a great job in many, many ways. And she came back to us and she said, we have no information. Now, we'd had a phone call the next night. We thought it was from the police. It wasn't. It was Kenyans, the travel international funeral directors, who are retained by nearly all of the airlines. But the questions they asked was the same as a police identification questionnaire. We assumed it was the police. They didn't identify themselves, or if they did, we didn't pick it up. And, you know, it takes 20 minutes to this. Yeah. Very harrowing thing for my wife, giving a description of our daughter. So we gave, there at the incident centre, we gave another description of our daughter. We went back home, and the next day, West Midlands police came. Could we give them a description of our daughter? Mm-hmm. So we did it again. We wanted to be helpful. So they went. A few hours later, we had a visit from the West Midlands CID from Smethwick, just down the road from us, a mile away. I said, well, look, you know, they said, we want to take fingerprints from her room. Has she got a toothbrush here or something? Nobody explained to us that they had to eliminate her from the proceedings, you know. Did she have any friends who were terrorists? And all this sort of stuff. So we said, go and help yourself. And then they came back and they wanted a description of our daughter. And I said, that was enough. I said, look, we had your people here yesterday. Oh, but they're the uniform branch. We're the CID. I said, well, don't you work for the same company? Go and talk to your uniform branch. And I showed them the door. I did phone up later and apologise for being so rude, but yeah.
You got received Helga's body back.
Oh yeah, we received the body back several weeks later. Well, 2 weeks later.
Right.
Yeah, she'd been left out for 4 days on the hillside above Tundergarth, with the foxes and the stoats and the crows and yeah.
Difficult.
While they collected baggage,
yeah,
they left her there.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a shame. It's really sad. But you would have had a funeral service for her then.
Yeah.
And
which I took.
You took that, yeah. And then you established a trust.
A Helga Moser Memorial Trust for the care and education of needy children, mainly for the care and education of needy children around the world. Mm-hmm. We have it's a little bit wider than that now, but we have a children's home in the Philippines for abused and abandoned children. One girl who's 4, and the aunt who was looking after her, father was in prison, mother was a drug addict, in a very remote area of the north of the Philippines, took her to and just dumped her in the city, 4 years old. And she survived a year living on rubbish. And then someone brought her to our missionaries who took her in. And then another boy who'd been left to die in the bush, a year old, because he had a cleft palate and a hare lip, couldn't suck at his mother's breast, couldn't afford to feed him, leave him to die in the bush. And they were brought to our people. They said, we've got to do something about this. So we built a home there, 28 kids. There's been 112 kids through that home today.
And that trust still runs?
That's just it still runs. One girl from the age of 6, raped on a weekly basis from the age of 6 by her uncle, a young guy, to the age of 15. A real messed up kid. She's been in our home 4 years now. She's straightened out. She's a lovely, lovely, lovely girl. And that's a typical story.
Right.
We also have another home in India, similar stories. And another place in Pakistan as well.
So instead of doing, you do good. You do good at every turn.
Yeah.
And through Helga's
don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil by doing good. We don't finance them all by ourselves. There are other churches that help us.
Yes.
And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some people would think, well, okay, you've been through that trauma, the loss of your daughter.
Yeah.
Now you've set up a trust, a fund, a memorial in her memory. That's enough. You'll just deal with whatever comes your way. Go back into almost normal life, whatever that is, or whatever that could be after something like that. But that hasn't been the case for you, has it, John?
No.
The whole thing of the Lockerbie bombing.
Yeah.
Trials, the whole political circus and arena, the legal proceedings that have gone on, still to this moment in time, you know, that there's still debates and discussions and hearings and still in the news, isn't it?
Yeah, and watch this space, there's some big things coming up in the next 6 to 12 months.
Okay.
I mean, from the very beginning, we've wanted an independent inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
We've never been happy about what we've been told about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of two people, the only two people of all the relatives that attended the whole of the trial in Holland.
Okay.
Dr. Swire and myself. I decided to go. I'd had a breakdown 8 years after it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd had to leave my church. Couldn't handle it anymore, and I was on the dole, so I decided to go to Holland to the trial. Dr. Swire heard that I was going, decided he wanted to come as well, and he's our main media spokesman, I suppose. That's happened. I mean, I do a lot of public speaking. I've spoken about it over 500 times in the following years at different venues, and we were there for the whole of the trial. I went with an open mind, whether these two Libyans were guilty or not. But I came away 85 to 90% convinced that they were not guilty.
Okay.
It was very clear early on in the trial, there's something going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Something's not quite kosher, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to put your finger on why, but it was a number of small things. There was someone pulling the strings somewhere. And I think now, I know that now we have absolute solid evidence that there were misdemeanors. And why, it's difficult to say, but it is very sad if we have got to live in a country where the legal system can be manipulated for international geopolitical purposes, mm-hmm. and the truth hidden from us. Mm-hmm. The Libyans were not guilty, mm-hmm. and the Crown Office knew it, mm. And our government knew it. Your government in Scotland knew it and didn't let the truth out.
Mm. And how has your faith enabled you to cope with dealing with those little bits that began, you know, those little dots that you began to join together, and the challenges that that you have faced for the legal system, the politicians, and some of them that you've met and had conversations with? How has your faith enabled you to stand and enabled you to keep your spirit sweet?
Well, I mean, we accept we live in a warped society, a warped world, a world that's gone from bad to worse in many, many ways. But we are confident that there's one day the truth will be out, even though it may not be while we're on this earth, because there's a higher court coming and the truth will out and no one will dodge it. But I think, you know, it's been more difficult to forgive the people that we thought were our friends, that we thought were on our side, mm-hmm. our Western governments, than to forgive the people who put the bomb on the plane. That's what terrorists do. They do that sort of thing. It's in their nature, whether it's for religious or political purposes, makes little difference. But when our Western governments have had at least 14 warnings, some of them very explicit, and a photograph of the bomb from the German police, which instead of being sent on the back of a motorcycle dispatch rider to Heathrow Security, was put by the Department of Transport in London, was put into the Christmas post and arrived a week after Christmas. Yeah. When American embassy in one country, in Moscow, puts a notice on their bulletin board, don't fly with Pan Am during the Christmas period because of intelligence received. When there's a phone call to the American embassy in Helsinki telling them all about it, and they knew, the authorities knew, which airline, which route, mm-hmm. Frankfurt, London, New York, mm-hmm. Detroit, mm-hmm. and they knew a time window, were given a time window of 2 weeks, all which was amazingly accurate. I think it happened the day after the 2 weeks expired, mm-hmm. and nothing was done except to warn some American embassies, to warn, well, Pik Botha, South African Foreign Secretary, and his entourage were booked on that flight. The man who was in charge of first class for Pan Am in London is a friend of my cousin's. There's a neighbour and a friend of my cousin's, and he was looking after important people. Mm-hmm. And they were taken off that flight and put on an earlier flight. But nobody told us.
Yeah.
That's been very difficult to forgive. Mm-hmm. We've had to work hard on that. The other was immediate and instant, uncannily so. Mm. But this has taken. We worked at it.
So how did you work at it? Maybe there's. We all face challenges and opportunities where we either decide to forgive people, or we can hold a grudge or a bitterness or a hardness of heart towards someone or something, a political system or.
So, I think it's been two things. It's been two things, really. It's been a spiritual thing and a common sense thing. The spiritual thing is, Jesus said, if we don't forgive, we are not forgiven. Mm-hmm. And after giving us the Lord's Prayer, where he says, forgive us our trespasses in the same way as we forgive those that trespass against us, mm-hmm. you know, and they said, if we don't forgive, we won't be forgiven.
Yeah.
You know, unforgiveness is not an option mm-hmm. for someone who calls themselves a Christian. Mm-hmm. It's not an option. It's a scary verse, that. One of the scariest in the Bible.
Yeah.
On the common sense side, I have seen, I've observed, as a minister, as a pastor, what bitterness and anger and unforgiveness can do to people. It's a cancer, it's a destroyer. Mm-hmm. When I was about 8 or 9, I think, maybe 10, 10 years of age. I had a friend in our street. His name was Michael, and he had to go into hospital with an appendicitis. And he went into hospital and had his appendix out. I think he was the same age as me. And he came home, and operation had been good. A few days later, he had to go back in again because there was an infection in the wound. And he went back into hospital, and a few days later, he died. Mm-hmm. Not of the appendicitis, but of the secondary infection.
Wow.
And bitterness and anger and unforgiveness is like that. This isn't a spiritual thing. This is common sense.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen it. It eats away. It destroys people's lives. Yeah. Get rid of it.
Get rid of unforgiveness.
Unforgiveness.
Yeah.
It wrecks churches. Mm-hmm. It wrecks families. It brings war, mm-hmm, between nations. Mm-hmm. It's an awful thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so forgiveness is the key.
That's, to me, it's been this spiritual thing and the common sense thing. Forgiveness is the key.
Cool. Brilliant.
You know, what was his name? Gone out of my head now. Forget it. 17th century English philosopher and theologian, whose name has gone out of my head now. He said, he who cannot forgive destroys the bridge over which he himself must pass.
That's deep.
Yeah.
It's deep. John, our time is beginning to just slip away from us. Yes. We enjoyed chatting with you and getting to know you and hearing your story, which is very real. I mean, it's now 25 years?
26
years old now, but it is still very vivid, very real. Can you just take just a couple of minutes to tell us how you've handled anniversaries? I know there have been some anniversary services, like 5th, the 10th, 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
And also, when you went to the trial, and you, how did you cope with that? How did you cope beyond it? And the opportunities that this whole thing has then brought. You know, the Bible says, what the enemy's planned for evil, God can use for good. And how has that now shaped your life and how you are? So maybe anniversaries first, and then...
Sure. Yeah, well, we've been determined to bring good out, to see good come out of this evil. Mm-hmm. And I said, but God, you've got to help us. And he has helped us. The 5th anniversary, we had formed a group straight away, almost straight away, called UK Families Flight 103. And we meet twice a year in various places. And... we decided to have an anniversary, and I said, well, they said, where shall we have it? We discussed various places, Coventry Cathedral, all sorts of places. I said, what about Westminster Abbey? Let's go for the nation's parish church. Yes. So I wrote to the dean, and we had Dr. Swire and myself and someone else had a meeting with the dean and the chapter. They were very kind. They said, by all means, use our building. So we had the 5th anniversary in Westminster Abbey. Now, not many Anglican vicars have preached in Westminster Abbey. I've preached there 3 times. and it's a great privilege and a great honour. And we had it there, and it was... that particular one was in the middle of the day, I think, if I've got it right. And I preached on Cain and Abel. When Cain, the first murder, he killed his brother Abel, mm-hmm, because of jealousy, really. Mm. And God came to Cain and said, the blood of your brother Abel is crying to me from the ground. Mm-hmm. And I said, there is the blood of 270 innocent people crying from the Scottish hillside. What are they crying? What is it crying? It's crying. And I made 3 points. First of all, a moral point, I suppose. It's crying. Why has this been allowed to happen? Mm-hmm. There were a lot of politicians there, mm-hmm, and that important people. Why has this been allowed to happen when there were so many warnings? Then they are also crying, bring something good out of our... Don't let our deaths be a waste of time. Mm-hmm. you know, to make sure, and we've tried to make flying safer. We've put pressure on the airlines and airports, and I think we've had some success. Mm-hmm. And on the governments and on the police, on dealing with bereaved relatives and one thing and another, we've made a small difference there, I think. I made a spiritual point. They are crying, be ye also ready, mm-hmm. for in such an hour as you think not. Mm-hmm. You know, our daughter was 19, whole life before her. There were babies on that plane, all sorts of ages. Average age was 27, I think, something like that. We never know. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to face your Maker? If your turn should come tomorrow, mm-hmm. are you ready? Then on the 10th anniversary, I was struggling. What should I pray? And my son, who is now our pastor and doing very well, he said, why don't you preach from Psalm 36, Dad? Mm-hmm. Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Mm. I'm sorry, I'm old King James when I'm quoting ad lib like this.
Yeah.
It's because I grew up with it. Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Trust in God, you know. And that one, we had virtually the whole cabinet there. Tony Blair sitting there, Prince Andrew, Tony Blair, Robin Cook, John Prescott. He couldn't get out quick enough. He was very uncomfortable in church. and the whole lot were there. And packed out place. This was in the evening at the time of the disaster. Mm-hmm. And then I preached on that, you know, that David, King David was always having to look over his shoulder. There was always someone trying to stab him in the back. Mm. But we must not become preoccupied with fighting our ogres. We must trust God. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, Tony Blair came to me and he and Cook were standing together. He said, thank you for that, John. He said, that was just for us. We needed to hear that. Will you send me a copy? So I sent him. Over the next year, I sent him three copies. We got the mad cow disease thing, so I sent him another copy. And then there was something else, and I sent him another copy. and then the 25th anniversary, we had it again there, and I preached on don't be overcome by evil. Mm-hmm. Overcome evil mm-hmm. by doing good. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right. So it has given us a platform that we never dreamed. When that first interview came, Gordon, on that first night afterwards, I thought, well, this will, media attention will last a week or two, and then the circus will move on.
Yes.
Little believing, little thinking, dreaming that 26 years later I'd still be talking about it. But people get helped with their anger and unforgiveness problems. People find a faith in Christ. Mm-hmm. For people who've gone through the mill, and there'll be people here with their own personal tragedies that the world knows nothing about. But people like that have found help, and for themselves, mm-hmm. it's worth pursuing.
It is. So let me just kind of recap some of the things, the important things, the spiritual things that you've said to this evening. You know, it's don't repay evil with evil, but let's repay it with good.
Yeah.
The need for to be forgiven by God, but to also operate out of that attitude and that spirit of forgiveness.
Yes.
And to live ready, not knowing at what point we may leave this world, die, and be ready to face God.
Yeah.
I suppose the other thing to say is that with forgiveness, that justice and judgment is still there. There will be a day where every single person will be called to give an account. And in that day, as you've already alluded to, then the truth will be known when we stand before God, our Maker and our Judge.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And if there's anybody that was here tonight and they're thinking, I need to be forgiven, I need to forgive, and I don't know that I'm ready to face God, in one sentence or two sentences, what would you say? How do they get ready?
I would say, first of all, face up to the facts. You don't need me to tell you that you're not even, none of us are even what we ourselves know we should be, let alone what God says we should be. We all come short. Face that fact and believe that through the death of Christ there is forgiveness. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, do it now. The Bible says, now is the, today is the day of salvation. Now is the accepted time. Do it now.
Yeah.
You may not feel like doing it tomorrow. And there is a pressure upon us at certain times which come from the Holy Spirit of God. And we need to respond while that is upon us.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, John. If you know that your life isn't, I suppose, right with God, that you're not ready to face Him, should it be required of you in your life, please come and talk to John at the end. Or there are some folks that are in church that are wearing little badges saying prayer team, that in various parts of their, hanging out a pocket or on their, on a jacket or something. Go and find them and speak to them. They've got some information that they would be able to give you and be able to pray with you to take those steps of recognizing that you need to do some business with God and get right with God. And we'd love to be able to show you and take you through those steps from the Bible as to what it is to become a friend of Jesus, to be forgiven of your past, and to enable you to have the strength to be able to forgive some other people. Now, we said that we would create some time for questions and answers. I just wonder, is there anybody who has a question tonight they would like to ask John about life, about ministry, about faith, about suffering, loss, before we sing one final song before heading home? I wonder, is there anybody, if you want to stick a hand up, I'll come to you with a mic.